The scientific community today, en masse, has rejected the creation model. It's been deemed unscientific, and naturalistic evolution has been knighted as the scientific choice. Ironically, when the scientific evidence is considered carefully, the evolutionary model is the option that's found to be unscientific. It contradicts scientific evidence, and the evidence which allegedly substantiates it disappears upon further study. Those who continue to support it after seeing the evidence have a blind faith, an irrational belief in evolution in spite of the empirical evidence. Those who see the decisive evidence against atheistic evolution and realize the implied conclusion from that evidence have no choice but to concede that there is a God who created the universe. There are several gaping chasms in the atheist's explanation for the origin of the universe, for life, and for man, significant questions that simply can't be answered by atheists, but which must be answered before naturalistic evolutionary theories, such as the Big Bang and Darwinian evolution, can be considered even a possibility, much less a fact. We looked at a few in our previous sessions. How could the laws of science come into existence on their own? How could a law write itself? How could matter and energy come into existence before the alleged Big Bang? How could anything create itself? And if not, how could the universe exist forever? How could the effect of this infinitely complex universe not have a cause? These questions and others that we'll be looking at are impenetrable barriers in the way of atheistic evolution. If evolutionary theories can't offer a reasonable explanation for how these chasms can be crossed, an explanation that harmonizes with the scientific evidence, then logically, those theories should be thrown out and replaced with a model that harmonizes with the evidence. Let's look at two other areas of science that shed light on the creation-evolution question. Consider the well-known, highly respected law of biogenesis, a law which describes how life works, where life comes from in nature. In order for atheistic evolution to be possible, the atheist must have an explanation for the origin of life without the need of a creator. So ultimately, in the evolutionary model, life had to come into existence from non-living substances. For millennia, up to a few hundred years ago, it was a common belief that life could in fact spring into existence from non-life, just pop into existence on its own, a belief known as spontaneous generation or abiogenesis. Then in the 1600s, Italian scientist Francesco Redi conducted scientific tests which cast serious doubt on the idea of spontaneous generation, but some were skeptical of his experiments and still thought that abiogenesis could occur. So Lazzaro Spallanzani conducted his own tests to investigate the criticisms of the skeptics, and he further substantiated the fact that abiogenesis does not occur. Rather, life comes only from life. Still, many were skeptical. Then in 1864, French scientist Louis Pasteur conducted experiments which drove nails into the coffin of spontaneous generation. One standard high school biology textbook, a textbook that's evolution-based, mind you, said, quote, "It was not until 1864 in the elegant experiment of French scientist Louis Pasteur that the hypothesis of spontaneous generation was finally disproved. Pasteur, like Redi and Spallanzani before him, had shown that life comes only from life." Life comes only from life. Even the evolutionists concede that truth. Granted, they have to admit it somewhat begrudgingly. The fact that life comes only from life is what is known as the law of biogenesis. So with that knowledge, the best that the naturalist can do is try to prove that abiogenesis still could happen in spite of the mounds of scientific evidence that have been gathered so far which repudiates it. All of this scientific experimentation and gathered data, Redi, Spallanzani, Pasteur, scientists never having observed any exception to the rule, and yet sadly, naturalists simply refuse to accept the conclusion from the scientific evidence. Instead, they pour endless hours and mounds of money into trying to get around the truth of the law of biogenesis. Just ignore the God option. Don't even consider it a possibility. Does that sound like a reasonable, unbiased approach to you? Well, regardless, there have been a stream of attempts to find evidence that life could come from non-life, to try to find evidence to substantiate evolution. All of these attempts, without exception, have not shown that life can come from non-life, but rather have further illustrated that life comes only from life. There are no known exceptions. Thus, biogenesis is a law, and the implication is that abiogenesis is impossible. Martin Moe, a prominent marine biologist and evolutionist, said, "A century of sensational discoveries in the biological sciences has taught us that life arises only from life." Evolutionist George Gaylord Simpson, perhaps the most influential paleontologist of the 20th century, said, "There's no serious doubt that biogenesis is the rule, that life comes only from other life, that a cell, the unit of life, is always and exclusively the product or offspring of another cell." In the biology textbook, Biology, A Search for Order in Complexity, Moore and Slusher wrote, "Historically, the point of view that life comes only from life has been so well established through the facts revealed by experiment that it is called the law of biogenesis." What does the scientific evidence indicate about the origin of life? Well, life creates life. And even the evolutionists, like these, admit this, and that yet they refuse to accept its implications. If atheistic evolution is true, abiogenesis must be true. But it can't be scientifically. Belief in abiogenesis is a stubborn refusal to accept the scientific evidence, choosing instead to believe in evolutionary superstition, myths, and fairy tales. In light of the extensive amount of scientific evidence against abiogenesis, how can the theory of evolution be given any attention, any credence? How do the evolutionists brush aside the evidence against abiogenesis? Amazingly, one typical response is for them to just come out and concede that life cannot come from non-life. They just admit that it's impossible, it can't happen. Evolutionist and Nobel Prize winner George Wald of Harvard University said concerning abiogenesis, "One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation. It's impossible, but I won't believe in God, so abiogenesis must have happened." It's common for evolution-based high school biology textbooks to just come out and admit spontaneous generation is impossible, come out and state that abiogenesis has been disproved, and even give the evidence for that claim, like this biology textbook by the popular textbook publisher Prentice Hall. After discussing Pasteur's experiments, the authors say, "The hypothesis of spontaneous generation was finally disproved." They then proceed, literally on the next page, to promote evolution and the origin of life from non-life. Sir Fred Hoyle, who was a distinguished atheistic British astronomer, and Chandra Wickramasinghe, professor of astronomy and applied mathematics at University College in Wales, who I've quoted in previous sessions, he said, "The probability of life originating at random is so utterly minuscule as to make the random concept absurd." The late evolutionist J.D. Bernal, one of the leading scientists among X-ray crystallographers, said, "It is possible to demonstrate effectively how life could not have arisen. The improbabilities are too great, the chances of the emergence of life too small. Regrettably, from this point of view, life is here on Earth, and the arguments have to be bent around to support its existence." You catch that? He says it's possible to show that abiogenesis is impossible. It can't happen. But evolution has to be true since we won't accept anything supernatural. So we'll just bend the arguments to make evolution possible. No wonder the McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms actually defines abiogenesis as, quote, "the obsolete concept that plant and animal life arise from non-living organic matter." But wait, if abiogenesis is impossible, if such a belief is considered obsolete, how could evolution still be considered credible by so many? And how did life get here without some sort of naturalistic explanation if you're an evolutionist? Surely they have a rational answer, right? When pressed for an answer to that question, many evolutionists literally throw their hands up and admit, "We don't have a clue." The late evolutionist John Maddox, writing in the prominent science magazine Nature, wrote, "It is disappointing that the origin of the genetic code is still as obscure as the origin of life itself." Evolutionary geologist Robert Hazen of Harvard, in his lecture series on the origin of life, he said recently, "The origin of life is a subject of immense complexity, and I have to tell you right up front, we don't know how life began. How can I tell you about the origin of life when we're so woefully ignorant of that history?" Evolutionist Paul Davies, theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist, and professor at Arizona State University, writing in New Scientist in 2006. He said, "One of the great outstanding scientific mysteries is the origin of life. How did it happen? The truth is, nobody has a clue." In previous sessions, I've quoted from prominent evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins of Oxford. He's one of the leading evolutionists in the world. In the 2008 documentary Expelled, Dawkins discussed the origin of life with Ben Stein. Dawkins said, "Nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life. It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule." Stein said, "Right, and how did that happen?" Dawkins said, "I've told you, we don't know." Stein says, "So you have no idea how it started?" Dawkins says, "No, nor has anybody." "Well, of course you don't know how it could happen, because it's been scientifically proven that it can't. So naturalistic evolution can't happen." Now notice that Dawkins claims that not only does he have no idea how life started, but according to him, nobody does. This extremely prominent evolutionist, considered one of the leaders in the field, admits that nobody has a clue how life began, not himself and not any of his evolutionary buddies. So they're not being able to create life in a lab. Nobody has a clue how life began. To all intents and purposes, it's impossible. It could not have created itself. So what is the naturalist left with? Well, a recent response to the abiogenesis problem by evolutionists is just to try to dodge the problem. Don't even face it. Don't answer it. Just claim that the origin of life is irrelevant to evolution, since the theory of evolution supposedly has nothing to do with the origin of life, but rather it starts with life already in existence and proceeds to explain how various forms of life have arrived on Earth from that original organism. I address that concept in depth in my book, Science vs. Evolution, on our website. You can attain that, www.apologeticspress.org. But let's look at this response briefly. Notice that this new dodge only potentially helps you if you're a theistic evolutionist and believe some form of God jumped in and kick-started life at the right moment. If that's true, then you don't have to worry about explaining how abiogenesis could happen. But if you're a theistic evolutionist, if you believe God was part of the equation, why would you try to kick him out of the scientific realm as the bulk of the evolutionary community is doing? Why wouldn't he be allowed in scientific discussion? Well, in reality, this argument is just a dodge from having to deal with the problem. The theory of evolution is a naturalistic theory. It's not a theistic idea. It was never designed to be a model that includes the option of a God. Otherwise, the creation model would have been retained. There's no room for God in the evolutionary model. If naturalism is correct, abiogenesis must have occurred at some point. The point can't be dodged. Evolutionists have coupled biology with evolution, and a study of biology must inevitably answer the question of the origin of life. That's why there's a whole field of evolutionary study called origin of life biology. If the origin of life is irrelevant to evolutionary biology, why would every textbook contain a discussion on the work of Pasteur and others who disproved abiogenesis? Evolution requires abiogenesis. That's why historically, abiogenesis has been considered a fundamental assumption of evolution. Years ago, Gerald A. Kirkut, a British zoologist and physiologist of Cambridge University, he listed abiogenesis as the first of seven non-provable assumptions upon which evolution is based. He said, "The first assumption is that non-living things gave rise to living material, i.e. spontaneous generation occurred. Abiogenesis has always been an assumed component of evolution in spite of the evidence against it. The problem can't be dodged. The evidence doesn't support evolution. It's unscientific." So what are naturalists left with? How could life get started on Earth without God? Enter directed panspermia. In order to come up with an answer to the abiogenesis problem without conceding God, some are literally leaving the planet. There's a growing belief in the claim that aliens brought life here and seeded it billions of years ago and then directed the evolution of life since then. After all, if evolution were true, it would be inconceivable for there to not be life, aliens, somewhere out there in the universe. The show Star Trek, of course, is based on that idea and explores it. Hoyle and Rick Ramasinghe are on record as subscribing to this view, as well as Nobel laureate Sir Francis Crick and Richard Dawkins. Naturalists will do anything to avoid the idea of God. There's absolutely no evidence for extraterrestrial life. It's pure speculation and wishful thinking for the atheist to try to solve the abiogenesis problem by resorting to aliens. That's why evolutionary astrophysicist and astronomy journalist Stuart Clark says, concerning the alien seeding theory, that its probability is so remote that it should be left aside. And yet evolutionists are still buying into the idea, of course, because they really don't have any options left. Consider Richard Dawkins' comments to Ben Stein in his documentary Expelled. Dawkins talked about the possibility of intelligent design, saying, "It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto, perhaps, this planet. Now, that's a possibility and an intriguing possibility, and I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that. If you look at the details of our chemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some kind of designer, and that designer could well be a higher intelligence from somewhere in the universe." Now wait, before we go any further, notice Dawkins, one of the most famous atheists of our day, admits that there could be evidence of design in our bodies, in our chemistry. That's an argument theists have made for centuries, the teleological argument for the existence of God. The design in the universe demands a universe designer. Dawkins actually conceded the possibility of God by making that statement. Now, granted, he flat out rejects the idea that the designer is the God of the Bible. Instead, he accepts aliens. There's no evidence for aliens, so it's a blind faith to believe in it. But there is evidence for the God of the Bible through the Bible's supernatural characteristics. Does this not illustrate the prejudice many in the atheistic community have against God? Now notice also what Dawkins said about those aliens. Quote, "But that higher intelligence would itself had to have come about by some ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously." So according to Dawkins, the supposed alien creators have been strapped with the laws of nature as well. They couldn't have just popped into existence. So he recognizes the truth of the law of biogenesis and that it applies to the whole universe, to the aliens as well, not just to Earth. He acknowledges that biogenesis would still have to be in effect on the aliens' home planet. So he admits that the problem of abiogenesis really isn't even solved by the alien seeding idea. It's just moved to the aliens' homeland, where the question of the origin of life still has to be answered and without resorting to abiogenesis. The truth is, abiogenesis isn't natural. We need another option. So let's get this straight. According to evolutionists, the origin of life through spontaneous generation, a fundamental plank of evolutionary theory, is impossible. The best they can do is try to dodge the issue or make up aliens to explain the origin of life. You can't blame them. I mean, what else are they left with to explain life? A miracle? How ironic it is that many evolutionists actually use religious terminology like that to describe the origin of life. Albeit they use the terminology incorrectly, and they use terminology like that in spite of the attacks that they themselves have made against the religiously minded community for using the same kind of terminology. Recall the renowned evolutionary astronomer Robert Jastrow. He said, "At present, science has no satisfactory answer to the question of the origin of life on the Earth. Perhaps the appearance of life on the Earth is a miracle. Scientists are reluctant to accept this view, but their choices are limited. Abiogenesis is also an act of faith. The act of faith consists in assuming that the scientific view of the origin of life is correct without having concrete evidence to support that belief." Now, the word faith is used by Jastrow here in the denominational sense, the view that faith is not based on evidence, but is merely a leap into the dark, accepting something without adequate evidence. That's not the biblical view of faith, as I've said in other sessions. Our faith in God is, in fact, based on the evidence. But the amazing thing is that some of the evolutionists are actually beginning to realize and admit that they lack evidence for their belief, that it's literally a blind, evidenceless faith that they are holding to by accepting evolution and abiogenesis. In other words, they're actually beginning to equate evolution with religion, which it is. Evolutionist and Nobel Prize winner Sir Francis Crick co-discovered the double helix structure of the DNA molecule. He acknowledged, quote, "An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it along." Evolutionary physiologist and zoologist Gerald Kirkut said that spontaneous generation is a matter of faith on the part of the biologists. The evidence for what did happen is not available. So ultimately, evolutionists don't have a clue how the theory of evolution could even get started. Abiogenesis is impossible. Its occurrence would have been miraculous. But of course, really, when Dawkins and Davies and the others say things like that, you know, it's a miracle, we don't have a clue how life got here, nobody does. What they really mean is no naturalist or atheistic evolutionist has a clue. Biblical supernaturalists, creationists, on the other hand, know exactly how life originated. And guess what? That belief harmonizes perfectly with the law of biogenesis. If the evidence indicates that in nature, life comes only from other similar life, then logically, the only way to be consistent with the evidence is to realize that there must be something outside of nature that initiated life. That's the only option that wouldn't contradict the scientific evidence. And the biblical model says that that's exactly what happened. How did living beings come to be, according to the creation model? By a supernatural God bringing it into existence. Jehovah God created life. He created living creatures. Life didn't spring into existence from nothing. God breathed life into man when he created him. Bottom line, the creation model is the scientific choice. The naturalistic evolutionary model is unscientific. Another implication of the law of biogenesis comes from the work of Rudolf Virchow. His work illustrated that not only does life come from life, but cells come from other similar cells. Life comes only from life of its kind. The McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms confirms this, defining biogenesis as the development of a living organism from a similar living organism. One popular life science textbook puts it this way, another characteristic of organisms is the ability to reproduce or produce offspring that are similar to the parents. For example, robins lay eggs that develop into young robins that closely resemble their parents. Robins make robins. There may be small differences in color, height, beak size, and so forth. Differences in changes that we call microevolution, which can be scientifically verified as change which actually occurs and which the creationist has no problem with. But even though there are changes, the offspring is still a robin. It's not a rhino and it's not a whale. Macroevolution hasn't happened. So in nature, life comes only from life of its own kind. Dogs don't give birth to cats and horses don't produce cows. Frogs don't have snakes. Apes don't give rise to humans. But if evolution is true, then that, in essence, is what had to happen. Simple lower life sprang into existence, and from that, over eons of time, complex life came about. So according to evolution, life does not come from life of its own kind, but rather from other kinds of life, in contradiction to the evidence, the law of biogenesis. In the field of philosophy, there's a law known as the law of excluded middle. That law says that every precisely stated proposition is either true or false. So as long as we precisely and clearly define what we're talking about, we can know whether something's true or false. If I say Bill is bald, well, as long as I precisely define what a bald person is, 100 hairs or less or something, then I can know if Bill is or isn't bald. As long as I precisely define what a human is, and scientists have done so, then everything either is or isn't a human. According to the law of biogenesis, a non-human will not give rise to a human. So again, the evolutionary theory contradicts the findings of science and requires that very thing to occur. Evolutionary theory is not in keeping with the scientific evidence on this matter. But the biblical model, once again, is in perfect harmony with the scientific evidence. God created life, created it according to its kind, and told it to reproduce according to its kind. Genesis 1, 11, 20, and 24. The biblical model doesn't have the problem of having to make the evolutionary jump between various kinds of creatures. God created life according to its kind, and those kinds have remained constant since creation, with only small variations occurring, changes which amount to microevolution, not macroevolution or Darwinian evolution. The idea that life comes only from life of its own kind leads us into another area of science, which I'll discuss somewhat briefly. Darwin's evolution has itself evolved over the decades, since evolutionists have had to admit time and again that it can't work the way they thought it could. The alleged evolutionary timeline has changed constantly. dates change as to when various animals supposedly lived. The order of evolutionary development has changed constantly. New theories as to why various animals develop their various body parts are constantly being revised. In fact, evolution itself didn't originate with Charles Darwin. Forms of evolution have been considered for millennia, and for millennia, those ideas have had to be revamped to stay in line with the latest scientific understanding. Darwin came along at the right time in history for evolutionary theory to become popular, so he's typically credited with coming up with evolution, but it by no means started with him. A fundamental component of his theory was natural selection. Natural selection is the idea that nature selects those species that are most fit or suited to a particular environment for survival. And those species which aren't as well suited and don't migrate to a different area, they're going to die out. So it's a filtering system. And that's by and large true. The creationist doesn't have a problem with that idea. The problem is that Darwin believed natural selection could be the means by which his evolutionary theory could happen. The idea that all forms of life came about from previously existing, less complex life, starting with a single cell eons ago. But scientists have realized today that Darwin was wrong about this. Natural selection alone couldn't cause evolution to occur. It might filter, but it can't create. Evolutionary paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard said, "The essence of Darwinism lies in a single phrase. Natural selection is the creative force of evolutionary change. No one denies that selection will play a negative role in eliminating the unfit. Darwinian theories require that it create the fit as well. And therein lies the problem. Evolutionists recognize that they can't even claim that natural selection could create the fit." Dutch evolutionary botanist Hugo de Vries long ago said, "Natural selection may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest." So evolutionists have realized that natural selection can't cut it. Enter neo-Darwinism. Neo-Darwinism is the idea that natural selection coupled with genetic mutations, DNA accidents, provides the mechanism for evolution to occur. So the idea is that every now and then a beneficial mutation might accidentally happen and it'll stick around without being selected out of existence because it accidentally makes a species more fit than other species that don't have that mutation. But that claim has problems because genetic mutations don't create new raw material or information, which is necessary for the kind of change required by evolutionary theory. Speaking of that issue, British engineer and physicist Alan Hayward said, "Mutations do not appear to bring progressive changes. Genes seem to be built so as to allow changes to occur within certain narrow limits and to prevent those limits from being crossed. To oversimplify a little, mutations very easily produce new varieties within a species and might occasionally produce a new, though similar, species. But despite enormous efforts by experimenters and breeders, mutations seem unable to produce entirely new forms of life." Gould said concerning mutations, "A mutation doesn't produce major new raw material. You don't make a new species by mutating the species. That's a common idea people have, that evolution is due to random mutations. A mutation is not the cause of evolutionary change." Now, when Gould said a mutation doesn't produce major new raw material, that's an important admission. New raw material, new information isn't added to the genome in a mutation. Let's think through the implications of that statement. Have you ever made a copy of a PDF on your computer or downloaded a copy of a PDF and opened it and found that errors had happened in the copying process? Those errors are like mutations in genetics. Maybe individual words were messed up, a few letters of a word were changed to other letters, termed codon errors in genetics. Maybe duplications could occur, which is the idea that words, sentences, even entire paragraphs could be duplicated in the book somewhere. Translocation could occur, which is the idea that chunks from one part of the book could just be moved from one area of the book and inserted into another area. Deletion could occur, which is the idea that chunks of the book could just be lost. These kinds of errors or mutations can occur, and there are others, but notice no new material is written when these errors or mutations occur. A new sentence hasn't been written into the PDF. The problem is that the theory of evolution requires new sentences and even chapters to have been written into the genetic book. In fact, it requires sequels of the book to write themselves. Codon errors, duplications, translocations, and deletions, These are mutations, but mutations don't add new information. They simply change something that already exists. They alter what's already there. They might cause a fly to have extra wings, a fish to have extra eyes, or a person to have an extra toe, but mutations can't create a new kind of creature. A mutation wouldn't cause a wing to appear on a creature unless the creature already had wings in its genetic code. In other words, using our book example, no new paragraphs or chapters can be written by mutations. And what that means is that if a living entity doesn't already have the genetic code to grow new parts, it can't grow them. So if you don't have antlers in your genes, you're not going to be able to grow them. If you don't have webbed duck feet in your genes or feathers, you're not going to be able to grow them. If you don't have tank tracks in your genes, you're never going to be able to roll on over to your neighbor's house, regardless of how long you live and regardless of how long you mutate. That's why evolutionist Pierre-Paul Grasset, who was the chair of evolution at the Sorbonne in Paris for over 30 years, he said, no matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. And like Gould and Hayward, evolutionists Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan came out and strongly expressed their disagreement with the idea that genetic mutations could be the mechanism for evolution, as neo-Darwinism contends. They said, mutation accumulation does not lead to new species or even to new organs or new tissues. Evolution contends that life started as a single cell and over millions of years has resulted in the human race. Neo-Darwinism theorizes that mutations can allow that kind of change, but in reality, that kind of evolution requires the addition of libraries and libraries of information into the genetic code, raw material that simply cannot come about due to random mutations. Recall this chart from our previous sessions, which details the fundamental planks of the naturalistic evolution and creation models. We've seen that the laws of thermodynamics and the law of causality prohibit the first two planks of the evolutionary chart. The universe couldn't have created itself or be eternal, and life requires a cause. That evidence alone is enough to destroy the false theory of naturalistic evolution, and yet there's more. The laws of probability add further weight to the fact that those planks do not harmonize with the evidence. And the law of biogenesis further illustrates that abiogenesis cannot occur, and neither can macroevolution, since life produces according to its kind. And finally, the evidence from genetics illustrates that macroevolution cannot happen. Neo-Darwinism, the mechanism for macroevolutionary change, is false because mutations, which are a fundamental component of neo-Darwinism, don't provide new information. Once again, the creation model has no problem with any of this scientific evidence. It harmonizes perfectly with all of these laws of science. Specifically regarding genetics, the creation model doesn't have to rely on neo-Darwinism to explain the existence of the kinds of creatures we see on Earth today, since according to the creation model, God created all creatures according to their kinds. The laws of science were written by God, so of course you would expect them to support the creation model. But when we study the evidence, the evolutionary model is riddled with issues. A few years ago, Philip Yam wrote in the journal Scientific American about new ideas that get brought up in the scientific community that contradict proven science. He said, certainly there should be room for far-out, potentially revolutionary ideas, but not at the expense of solid science. Though he wasn't directly speaking about evolution, what a telling statement. What can be more solid science than the laws of science? And what theory comes more in conflict with solid science than atheistic evolution? Truly, it's a mystery as to why evolution can even be deemed a scientific theory, since it doesn't have supporting evidence for several of its fundamental planks. If upon gathering scientific evidence, a person continues to find constant contradiction with a theory and finds that there seems to be a never-ending readjustment of a theory to keep it in line with the evidence, at some point, one should wonder whether the theory should be thrown out in favor of a belief that does not constantly contradict the evidence. Wouldn't that be the logical approach? Wouldn't that be the scientific, unbiased, unprejudiced approach? Shouldn't a person be pretty suspicious of any theory that has to be continually revamped over and over throughout centuries and even millennia in order to keep it alive? Bottom line, if evolution is true, science should support it. If creation is true, science should support it. Why would science lie? The truth is, science supports the creation model and not the evolutionary model. Note that creationists don't have to jump through hoops to stay in line with evidence. The creationist platform is in perfect harmony with the laws of science. We're comfortable. And that should describe anyone who's holding to truth. One shouldn't have to adjust and jump through hoops constantly to maintain a belief if it is the truth. But notice, evolutionists must constantly adapt and come up with new theories to try to postpone the inevitable. The theories they propose have no basis in fact. They're just frantic attempts to prop up a failed theory while creating the illusion that it has scientific substance and will one day be verified. But notice carefully that each time the new revised theory is shown to be false, the laws of science are still standing as a lighthouse to those who are unbiased and interested enough in finding the truth. There's a lawmaker that governs the earth, and it's rational to believe in him. In the next few sessions, we'll study the alleged evidences for evolution to see if they do, in fact, provide support for naturalism.
This has been a presentation of Apologetics Press, an organization dedicated to the defense of New Testament Christianity. Visit us on the web at apologeticspress.org or call 800-234-8558.